On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats to answer these questions. Can the brand new Luka 2.0 finally break through and win his first MVP? And will the Lakers be good enough to get him over the top? Also, will the Phoenix Suns trade for Jonathan Kuminga? All this coming up right now. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to The Big Number. I'm Tom Haverstroh, and that is my man, Dan Devine. Dan, what's going on? How's your summer going?
It's going great. I'm activating my glutes. I'm working on my box jumps. I am really out here. I've been fasting, not even intermittently, like consistently. So I feel like I'm about to shred in a way that's really unprecedented for me and kind of putting me in position to have my best year, Tom. So does that at all relate to what we're talking about today?
Yeah, we're doing our summer dad bod pod of the summer here.
That's right.
We're working out, making sure we do that trap bar deadlift that a certain Luka Doncic has been doing out in Slovenia, or is it Croatia? I don't know. That's what our big number is about this week. This week's big number is 1.4. That's the cumulative number of MVPs that NBA GMs have expected for Luka Doncic over the last five seasons, based on the annual preseason NBA GM survey that our guy John Schumann does and compiles over at NBA.com. This is the highest figure that we have seen for any player over the last 5 years. Like, he is expected to win the MVP pretty much every year, at least be in the top three. And yet, Dan, he has not won the MVP once. So I bring this up because, Dan, we did see this Men's Health digital cover story. I don't even know if it's an actual, like, hardcover pet cover story. Like, is it an analog cover story, which would be just like the hard cover story? Like, what is the equivalent of the, is Men's Health in circulation in a hardcover is my question. Probably doesn't bode well that I don't know that answer.
I think the answer is probably yes. And I think we should call it a dead tree cover story. And the trees are dead because Luke has been chopping them down, getting his hands in there and just over and over again to get like that Rocky IV, I'm in the mountains shred going. It was when it dropped on the internet, like it just descended and plopped down on top of all of us, like an absolute perfect rollout for like late summer, nothing to talk about. Hey, check out what I've been doing. Like, let's shock the gram kind of situation. It certainly raised eyebrows. It generated a ton of interest around the league because I think the expectation is, oh, wait, if Luka has been this good over the course of his career, without being in, let's say, optimal shape all times, what if he actually is taking that as seriously as he's ever taken it, motivated perhaps in part by the
bless you. Sorry.
The widely rumored and reported, sourced but anonymous discussions of the questions surrounding Luka's commitment to his physical conditioning being a reason for concern that the Dallas Mavericks had about extending him a 5-year supermax contract, which then led to all the machinations that landed him in LA, which it turns out, if you give somebody a motivating factor like, we don't think that you're going to be in good enough shape, maybe that motivates them to get in shape to the tune of a multi-story, multi-page, multi-photo shoot spread in Men's Health magazine.
Yeah, what was your favorite tidbit from this profile? The fact that he's giving out stool samples and urine samples to figure this out.
Giving out sounds like he's out. He's the Slovenian train station. You know, being like, hey, can I interest anybody? I don't think that was the way it went.
But yes, I thought people would line up. I think they would. If it's Luka Doncic's, I feel like people would be like, you know what? I think my nephew would really enjoy this to put it on his nightstand at night.
Oh, God.
I don't know. It just, I just feel like most people, I wouldn't be like, I would like your bodily fluids there. But if it's Luka Doncic, who's this guy, he's a god over there. And also over here too, people revere this guy. It's different. I'm going to segue here. The 250 grams of protein shake or protein that he's consuming a day. And I learned because I interviewed for Basketball Illuminati. We interviewed the guy who wrote this piece, one of the two authors, and he said, and Dan, I want to run this by you, and if you're doing that, he said, like, there's a rough rule of thumb that you should consume 1 gram of protein every day for your each pound of your body weight.
Okay.
I don't think I'm doing that at all. Okay. So 250 grams of protein, at first I was like, how do you it's like, and what he said was it was like five or six chicken breasts that right, he has okay. to consume. And it's like, he's intermittent fasting in there, Dan. So like, he basically has like a lunch and a dinner to consume like an entire cow is really what it comes down to.
That's, I mean, I guess the only way I could conceivably get there is like, how many grams of protein are in 1 spoonful of peanut butter every time you enter the kitchen? Like what, how much protein am I getting there? And then if I'm doing that 210 or so times, yeah, then maybe I'm in the ballpark. I don't know. But I think the non-silly takeaway is if like, this is the longest stretch that Luka will have had like off for a while, right? Like the Lakers lose at the end of April, beginning of May. He gets several months off before Slovenia gets going in Eurobasket. And that idea of like, he hasn't been able to step back and not like he played into deep June last year, then also had to work for Slovenia in the qualifying, the Olympic qualifying tournament. He's had like been coming off of injuries or coming off of different situations. Like this is the most concerted time he's had to like rest and rebuild and reimagine what his routine looks like. And even coming last season where he was coming off a calf strain, only played 50 games. When he was on the court, he was still remarkable, you know? So the idea of a refreshed, rested and sort of recommitted Luka heading into next season kind of puts another superstar back on the map in a way that for a lot of last season, we didn't have one and could very well make for a more interesting MVP race. Not that we've had any shortage of those the last few seasons, but add yet another like high level competitor back into that mix.
I think when you put it into that context, we should bring this up, the fact that like Luka Doncic has been, I think, the biggest underachiever when it comes to the MVP race. And I'm not saying that he's been bad. Sure. He's been an outstanding basketball player. But every year we seem to think that Luka Doncic is the favorite to win MVP. And he's only had 4 first place votes over the last 5 seasons. He's only been
4 total first place votes?
Four wow. total first place votes, and they all came in a couple years ago in one season. So there's been only one time where he has gotten a first place vote over his last 5 seasons, actually in his career. But using this GM survey, Dan, as like a proxy for hype, the MVP race hype coming into a season, he's finished top 5 in MVP odds in each of the last 5 seasons, and that's the only player in the NBA to do so. Not even Giannis, not Shai Gilgeous Alexander. Jokic has actually only been top 5 once in the last 5 seasons. So that's insane. By the way, he's won 3 MVPs over that span, but he's not been nearly as prolific in this conversation of preseason MVP favorites. And Luka, he earned the second most votes last season, the 4th most in 2023-24. And in the previous 3 seasons before that, he was first, second, and first in the preseason MVP odds, according to NBA GM. So you could say GMs are a little too anxious for Luka to be dominating the league. And maybe their underlings in the front office were actually filling these things out. That's always been a thing, is who are they really actually the GMs sitting there grind? Is Sam Presti really grinding out his NBA.com annual survey vote? I am skeptical of this. But the point is that like Luka Doncic has not lived up to the billing of being the MVP in the upcoming season. And I think that's more reflective of him being a postseason overachiever and then coming off that postseason where he takes his team all the way to the NBA finals or gets further than what I think a lot of people were expecting. I think the media or NBA front offices just think that that's going to carry over into the regular season. But Luka Doncic, even if he's Luka 2.0, as the Men's Health magazine said, I have a hard time convincing myself that this is going to be the year. Because, Dan, that means that the Lakers have to overachieve in the Western Conference, because that, to me, is the biggest thing that's going to drive his campaign. Yes, he's going to look thinner. He potentially is going to be healthier. But, like, do we really believe in the Lakers this upcoming season? And I know we have lots of numbers to get into here coming out of the break. But, Dan, I wanted to ask you, are you in your 2.0 phase? Where are you in your life? Because I was wondering about this. He's 26 years old and he's already at 2.0. Where are we at?
I think I'm actually regressing. I might be like in the 0.6. I feel like I'm getting worse. I'm aging. I'm losing facility. I'm not getting faster or stronger or better. I'm just kind of degrading slowly. That's me. Like, I'm not. Yeah. Other people might feel like they get better with age. Tom, what about you? Do you feel like the numbers are going up? Like Luka 2.0, Megan 2.0, Haberstroh 2.0?
Yeah, I think. You know how Apple sometimes like goes back to like not a dumb version of their phone, but like a smaller version of their phone, or just a less like sophisticated.
Yeah, we're rolling it back. Yeah.
Rolling it back. Like a 0.6 sounds right. I got this beard here that like I've been working on the last like week or so, which when I shave this off in the summer, it's going to be an amazing, like very pale skin under here.
That's right. The tan lines.
But this is my Tom Segura look. This is my, I guess Taylor Jenkins might be the best comp here, NBA-wise, would you say?
I was going to give you the benefit of a Tony Parker in this situation. I feel like, you know, there's a sophistication, a worldliness to the Haberstroh scruff here. I mean, listen, I'm obviously biased. I stay with a beard because God forbid I show you my real face, but I feel like you've got something, you've unlocked something here. So to me, from the outside looking in, I'm calling this at least a Tom 1.4.
Oh, I love this. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. That is the big number this week. 1.4. I actually should run through this real quick for the listeners. Yeah. Like what I basically did was took the percentage share, because the MVP votes that the GMs do, it's not always like clean how many votes they have. They do Schumann writes like the percentages of the votes. So you add up all the percentages and you get to 142% over the last five seasons. So if he had 40% 1 year plus 20% plus 27%, he's at 142%. Giannis comes in at 102%. Jokic at 54%. He's got three MVPs.
That's nuts.
And the total number of votes that he's gotten, it shakes out to 54% of the vote over 5 years. Kevin Durant is in fourth most over the last 5 years at 48%. He hasn't won an MVP over that span. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander at 44% and Joel Embiid at 32%. They both, those last two, have won an MVP. And yet Luka Doncic, who has gotten the most MVP love, preseason love out of any of them, is still looking for his first. And this one might be it. 2.0, 250 grams of protein and an almond milk shake every day. I don't know why the almond milk part is in there. Like, I guess that's healthier, so to speak. But we're going to talk about whether the Lakers can do this, whether the Lakers and Luka Doncic can help him win his first MVP with four little numbers, Dan, right after the break. All right, we're back. We tried to get Luka Doncic on this show, the big number. And if you're listening, Luka...
And you are.
We know you are. In the midst of going to the Yankees game, and people are upset about him being wearing a Yankees hat. I mean, the guy's from Slovenia. Like, of all baseball teams, wouldn't you think that, like, the brand of the Yankees would be something that a Slovenian kid would be like, yeah, or Derek Jeter. I mean, he's part of the Jordan brand. I'm not worried about this. I'm a Red Sox fan. I'm not too messed up about Luka Doncic putting on a Yankees hat. I think when you look at LeBron and Luka, maybe they can share some Yankees lore together. Or maybe not. I don't know if they're very close these days, Luka and LeBron. Did notice not one mention of LeBron in that Men's Health story, by the way. There was no like, you know, I work out a lot and I got a lot of, you know, inspiration from number 23 on the Lakers. None of that talk, Dan.
Well, I mean, there was a lot of discussion of trap bars and band, you know, resistance band workouts, not so much about Versa Climber sessions. So maybe it's just that they're doing different things. It's just, you know, like you're in that part of the gym, I'm in this part of the gym, you know, quick head nod and what's up, but that's about all. Listen, I mean, what I can only hope is Luka showing up in New York and going to a Yankees game is going to start, what, 15 straight years of is Luka coming to the Knicks? Because that's what happened with LeBron. So maybe it'll be like a new substream of content slurry going to, you know, be coming down the pike for everybody. Something to look forward to in our future.
Are you just
ahead.
Doing the little numbers on which train he's going to take when he becomes a member of the Knicks? Is that Got the... It.
Yeah, Luka's definitely going to take the train. I think let's get that out there. He's pretty concerned about congestion pricing, so he's going to be out there just, you know, getting on the subway. Got to keep the fares down. Luka Doncic hopping the turnstiles. You know, real true New Yorker.
Well, now he's got this vertical leap, you know, because of this this new diet that he's doing that reportedly 42 inches. Don't think that's accurate. But anyway, what is, I don't think 42 is your first big number here, but it might be close to that, Dan. What's your first little number for the audience here?
It was going to be 42, but let's cross that one out. We'll go right down. So the first little number this week is 47.5. That is the over-under number on the Lakers win total for next season, according to BetMGM. 47.5 wins. It's an interesting number. Because it's fewer wins than the Lakers had last season when they finished with 50 wins. But also, the only players to ever win MVP with their teams winning 47 or fewer games in an 82-game season. So we're going to take out like the lockout shortened seasons and the COVID shortened seasons where there were fewer games. 47 or fewer in an 82-game season, MVP winners. Bob Pettit, 1956. Kareem, 1976. Moses Malone in 1979 and 1982, and Russell Westbrook in 2017. So only once in the past 43 years has somebody won fewer than 48 games and won MVP, which is to say, it seems likely that if Luka wants to have a shot at MVP, the Lakers are going to have to beat that over. They're going to have to win 48 or more games, and in all likelihood, a lot more than 48 games. I guess, Tom, just start here. Like, what do you think the likelihood is of that happening?
I don't think it's very high. I think also, remember, like, their rotation is going to be pretty new here. We got a new starting center in DeAndre Ayton. DA is going to be, you know, catching a lot of lobs from them and some, you know, 12-foot mid-range jumpers right around the free throw line. There's going to take some time of integrating him, Jake LaRavia, Marcus Smart also joining the squad. And I think, like, the Luka, LeBron, and Austin Reeves trio that at some times were being considered like the best big three, or Austin Reeves was the best third fiddle in the NBA. I think in the postseason we saw that it isn't totally as impactful as you would like, just stacking their talent and stacking their abilities. And so I do think there's going to be some time for them to kind of integrate. And with all this offseason drama, I could see that, like, LeBron's motives or Luka's motives or Austin Reeves, who's still dealing with an extension in the future of his NBA career, kind of in balance. I feel like I don't feel like they're going to get off to a great start. And if they don't get off to a great start, then I just have this feeling that LeBron, with his no trade clause, he might start trying to figure out a way to end the season in a winning capacity or trying to win a championship. I just don't think that this Lakers team is set up to really bang the over. Even with Luka Doncic looking as svelte as he does, skinny Luka, to me, I would feel better about this if they had a lot of their rotation coming back this year. DFS, Dorian Finney-Smith not coming back this year. And in his place is Jake LaRavia, who's a nice replacement for DFS, but not necessarily the kind of 3-and-D capabilities that he brought to the team last year, and the veteran guy who's played in postseasons before. So I kind of feel like I'm taking the under on the Lakers, especially with how the rest of the Western Conference looks. And I just think that no matter how good Luka Doncic looks next season, if that supporting cast isn't going above and beyond expectations, I just don't think he has a great shot.
Yeah, for the record, Lakers went 18-10 in the 28 games that Luka played after he arrived in LA. So that's a 53-win pace over an 82-game slate. So just putting that out there. They also didn't have any centers, and they still did that. So for the record, I'm going to Euro step through the little numbers a little bit and sort of reorganize, because it picks up on what we just were talking about there. Second little number is 121.3. That was the Lakers' defensive rating last season when Luka Doncic, LeBron James, and Austin Reeves all shared the court. If 121.3 sounds like a big number, that's because it is. That would have finished dead last in the NBA during the regular season. That would be worse than the Pelicans and the Jazz, who, as you might remember, were awful. That number with the defensive efficiency numbers there, courtesy of our friends at PBP Stats. So at the risk of offering some pretty simple analysis, if when you have your top three players on the floor, you're the worst defense in the NBA, you're probably not going to be a contender, which means you're probably not going to be an MVP candidate, right? Like, you know, if then, as we go through the flowchart. So you mentioned some of the adjustments and changes that the Lakers have made to their rotation in the offseason. What do you think their chances are that those moves, you know, bringing in Ayton, bringing in Marcus Smart, et cetera, lead to an improved defense or an improved enough defense to get Luka up near the top of that pack?
Yeah. Again, like LeBron at age 40, we're going to be asking a lot of him to be playing at an extremely high level and racing around the floor like he did a lot last season. It's a different year. And I kind of feel like when you're asking LeBron to do that, he has to be bought in 100% and Luka has to be bought in 100%. I just don't know if that's true, because if they're going to improve on that 121 figure of those three guys on the floor, they've all got to be locked in, all on the same page, and not having competing agendas, not having different kind of goals for this season. And when you look at, in particular, DeAndre Ayton, when he was on the floor for the Blazers last year, they had 117 defensive rating when he was on the floor, 117 points every 100 possessions allowed. And when he hit the bench, it went down to 111. So it improved by 6 points every 100 possessions when he hit the bench. Okay. Donovan Klingon, Rob Williams III, these guys are awesome rim protectors and more kind of like defensive-minded rim protectors. I think Rob Williams should have won the Defensive Player of the Year over Marcus Smart, Lakers Marcus Smart, which is weird to say.
Yeah.
So DeAndre Ayton, he's got his hands full. If he wants to have like... In many ways, Dan, that number, that little number that you just gave, it really comes down to, do you think that DeAndre Ayton can, and Marcus Smart to a lesser extent, I don't know if he's going to be playing as much as DA will, do you think that they can collectively improve the defense to such a degree that Luka and the Lakers can supersede expectations and essentially go to like a 54-win season? And then I think you hear a lot of MVP chatter.
Yeah, and there's a squint and you can see it kind of way it unfolds, right? Like Ayton is not a dominant rim protector, but huge, long arm wingspan, really sort of nimble on the perimeter, can move out there. You bring in Smart, who might not be like the number one lock you down point of attack defender against opposing guards that he used to be, maybe a little bit better using his strength to guard up in positions, but a really smart help defender, somebody who can, you know, dig down, get into gaps, you know, spring in a surprise double. Laravia, also kind of a good gap defender, you know, getting his hand in the passing lane for deflections. Obviously, LeBron and Luka, super duper smart, capable of creating that kind of havoc. Like, you can see a way it all works, but what, in order for it to work, it's going to have to be like, we're not getting broken down at the top of the key, which tough with Austin Reeves and LeBron and Luka out there. And you're going to have to say, we're going to clean up those mistakes on the back line, puts a lot on Ayton. So yeah, there's a significant task ahead for JJ Redick to try to sort of figure out what the scheme looks like to maximize those guys, protect him, cover for him. And for those guys to be able to execute it is going to be a big challenge for the Lakers heading into the season. Kind of brings us to our third little number, 3.1. That's the average finish in net rating of MVP winners since 2000. So what I mean by that is net rating is just how many points does your team outscore the opponent by over a course of 100 possessions. If your team outscores the opponent by a lot of points, you're a good team. If your team gets outscored by a lot of points per 100 possessions, you're a bad team. And most of the time, shockingly, the MVP comes from a good team, one that has a near the top of the league net rating. Since 2000, so I mean, rather than going back all the way to since forever, but since 2000, quarter century, the MVP winner has come from the team that finished first in net rating 8 times, the team that finished second 5 times, team that finished third 6 times, and the team that finished fourth four times. So that's 23 of the 26 MVPs since 2000 have come from a top four finishing team in net rating. So you average it all out, 3.1. Your outliers, two Nikola Jokic seasons. 2021, they finished sixth. That was where Murray gets hurt late in the season and he carries them the rest of the way. Jokic in 2022, they don't have Murray at all. They finish 11th in net rating. He carries them the whole way. And the aforementioned Russell Westbrook 2017 season, Thunder finish 11th. He carries them without KD. It's also the first triple-double average since Oscar Robertson. So that really, you know, stuck out in people's minds. So all that said, kind of seems like the historical precedent here is either Luka has to carry a Lakers team that's been like ravaged by injuries all by himself to respectability, or the mostly healthy Lakers have to be a top four, top five team in terms of net rating in the whole NBA. Again, does that seem more or less likely to you given what we know about the Lakers heading into this season?
Yeah, the Lakers last year overachieved based on their net rating, right? Like their Pythagorean win-loss record was a 44-win team based on just how often they outscored opponents or the margin by which they outscored opponents. You would have thought they were a 44-win team. But because of LeBron's clutchness and Austin Reeves and all the stuff that went their way in really late and close situations, they ended up with a 50-win team. So based on that they already way overachieved in the regular season last year, do they have that same sort of magic left in their back pocket or in their little magical pouch to sprinkle on their season next year? Dan, I don't know. Like there's the exceeding your point differential, or at least like being super clutch, doesn't seem to carry over as much as we'd like to think from year to year. So the fact that the Lakers exceeded their very pedestrian 500-win team right around point differential last year, I don't think they were going to get that net rating up. They were not that team last year. And given all the new pieces, I just don't see them ranking in the top three in net rating this year, especially in the Western Conference. That's going to be a bloodbath. If they're in the Eastern Conference, yeah, maybe they would just because of the nature of how the schedule breaks out. But in the West, I just have a hard time seeing it.
For the record again, just, you know, lest we get a deluge of comments from the West Coast hating on us, the Lakers did outscore opponents by 8.4 points per 100 possessions with Luka Doncic on the court last year. Plus 8.4 net rating would have finished fourth for the full season. So there is at least some evidence that having Luka on the court...
He's got to play 48 minutes. Has to play 48 minutes is what you're saying.
I think, well, certainly that would be a good start. But Tom, how curious that you led us to playing, because that is the subject of our fourth and final little number, 63. That is how many games Luka Doncic has averaged per season over the last 4 years. Now, obviously, that number is depressed a little bit because he only played 50 last year with the calf strain. But even before that.
Yep.
2021-22 season, 65 games. 22-23, 66 games. 23-24, 70 games. That's missing a significant chunk of time in each of those seasons. And then, like, as we've now moved into the era where you have to hit that 65-game threshold to be able to be eligible for end-season awards, it's like Luka's kind of just getting past that, like just getting over the line there to make sure he can make All-NBA, make sure he can make the MVP ballot. So as long as he can get over 65 games, he'll be eligible for those things. But when you think about a world where, like, Nikola Jokic never misses time, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander plays a ton, Giannis, when his health has been up and down, but when he's available, plays a ton of minutes. Like, at the risk of offering some very basic analysis, the more Luka plays, the more games he plays, the better his chances of having, like, such an overwhelming impact that he can, like, stand toe-to-toe with those guys or outshine them, right?
The last time that Luka looked like this, I think, was his rookie season, right? And he played 72 out of 82 in that regular season, right? So there's precedent on that front. And then also, he's going to have to basically, if he wants to win MVP, he's going to have to basically repeat the 23-24 season, in which he played 70 games and averaged 33.9 points, 9.8 assists, and 9.2 rebounds. I will say this: if he averages a triple double for the Lakers next year, it's over. It's a wrap. Like, he's going to win MVP. Part of that is he's going to have to qualify just like he did with 70 games a couple years ago, and he only got four first place MVP votes. But I feel like if he gets over those triple double numbers, he'll be a shoo-in, especially with the story of doing it for the Lakers and all the winning that comes with that of averaging a triple double. It's going to be similar to that Russell Westbrook season in 2017, where it's just like, yeah, if he's just in the playoffs or in the top six, right, averages a triple double, I think the story is going to be there. But changing your body weight and changing the way your movement patterns from year to year so drastically, I wonder if there's almost an increased injury risk already just from shedding that much weight that quickly. But I'm no expert. I'm just saying, on one hand, he is looking very thin and looking very strong and very motivated, but they're going to have to do a lot of work, which it sounds like from reading that Men's Health article, they're doing a lot of on-court work to kind of strengthen all of the elements that led to those calf strains, or kind of lowering your risk factors for that calf strain to start barking up again. If he can keep that at bay, then yes, he can get to that 65 or over threshold for Luka. But as you wisely pointed out, it's not like he was averaging 80 games before last season. And the most recent season being your most injury riddled season, that's important, right? It's one of the reasons why he looks the way he does right now is because he had such a miserable time trying to get back onto the floor last year, in addition to the Nico Harrison trade.
Yeah, the glass half full view of that is the most serious, like, soft tissue issue that you've had over the course of your career, the most serious significant injury you've had over the course of your career, that combined with the trade, combined with the first round exit, that is like a pretty significant wake up call and significant call to arms that has led him to, I guess, I don't know, call to his arms. Like, his like striations out there are nuts. He's out here looking shredded like a YouTube clip. But it is, we've put ourselves in position now with Luka Doncic to where all of the arrows seem to be pointing in the same direction. Like, he's approaching his peak. He's got the motivation. The Lakers are going to be built around him. He's got more help that they've brought together. Now all that's left is to put it all together and hopefully get the best version of him we've ever seen. If we do that, as you said, doing it in LA for a Lakers team that would be then be competing for a top spot out West, the story, all the narratives, everything could kind of like line up together for him in a way that it hasn't just yet, to be determined.
To be determined is a good way to segue into our next segment here. We're going to talk about the restricted free agency Big Four: Jonathan Kuminga, Josh Giddey, Cam Thomas, and Quentin Grimes. As of this recording, and our producer Stone will keep us updated as we go, whether there's going to be breaking news as we record this. But just like Luka and the preseason MVP hype that never really comes to fruition, I feel like the Kuminga news, we've been waiting and waiting for this to happen, and yet we are still here on July 30th around lunchtime and still have not gotten any sort of clarity on where this is going to head or when this whole saga. And poor Al Horford is just out here. I don't know if he's in Santo Domingo and the Dominican and just waiting for news to drop with his family. I don't know what he's doing, but he's certainly not signing quite yet with the Golden State Warriors or anybody until this thing, it seems, to get settled. So we're going to talk about the four RFA big names here that haven't signed. We're going to talk about where they might eventually land with their contracts or their new teams, if there are going to have new teams, right after the break. RFA, restricted free agents, basically a guy in this situation, a free agent, has to basically bring an offer sheet from another team if they want to sign with someone else to their incumbent team. And it creates all this sort of problems for the restricted free agent, in this case, Jonathan Kuminga, Josh Giddey with the Chicago Bills, Chicago Bulls. I don't know why I said Bills. Camp football's around the corner. Cam Thomas over with the Brooklyn Nets, and then Quentin Grimes over with the Philadelphia 76ers, all kind of sitting here waiting for this to play itself out. And we might be in September. We might be even in like October waiting to find out what's going to happen with these guys. They can get signed and traded. They might take a qualifying offer, which means you take basically a small percentage of your expected salary to come back to your incumbent team. And you're an unrestricted free agent at the end of the season. You don't have your bird rights in case you get traded, which is not going to be an appetizing situation for another team. And also, it's not a fun situation, basically, to have that kind of breakdown in contract talks. And then you got to go back to your team and try to play for your next contract and basically say, bye-bye, after this, I'm gone. Not a really rosy situation. Dan, we had one RFA deal, like big one, is Santi Aldama from the Memphis Grizzlies. He had a $52.5 million deal, about 17.5 annual average annual salary with the Memphis Grizzlies. And that was like at the outset of free agency. And at this point, it's been almost a month. It's been a month. And we don't have any sort of real momentum with Kuminga and Josh Giddey and Cam Thomas and Quentin Grimes. Which do you think of those four will have a resolution the soonest? Which one of those, between Kuminga and Golden State, Giddey in Chicago, Cam Thomas in Brooklyn, Quentin Grimes in Philly, which one do you feel like we've reached the end point of this standoff and we're going to just come to a deal?
Well, yeah, it's interesting because the reason that it does get dragged out, and we see this many summers. Like, I can remember writing a whole big thing about this, like when Eric Bledsoe was in RFA with the Suns, whatever that was, like 2012 or 13, about like, this is what restricted free agency is for. It's for teams to use it kind of as a cudgel and a way to protect against themselves so that they don't have to bid against themselves, right? Like, we have seen this before. I think we've rarely seen it with like four guys at the same time. But the reason everything's going so slowly is because there is no cap space on the market. There really wasn't any cap space on the market. The only team that had significant cap space on the market was the Nets. And they are deciding like, well, even though we can go over the line here to sign Cam Thomas, like, nobody else is gonna. So like, why are we gonna? And there are teams that can create, like if the Jazz decided they wanted to start messing around, they can do it. But I don't think the Jazz seems super motivated to go out and get more talent on the roster. So in that case, there's no real motivation to get it moving. So then like, what leads to a resolution coming? One would be like, if there are no hard feelings and it's just kind of like, well, everybody wants this, so let's move forward. And that would seem to be Quentin Grimes to me. Like, I think, idea is everyone seems like pretty on board for the idea that Quentin Grimes should be on the 76ers next season and that he would be a good person to have around on the theoretical healthier version of the 76ers that we've talked about on this show. And the Sixers have already indicated their interest in doing that by letting Gershon Yabusele walk, because if they would have gone into, I think it was gone into their taxpayer mid-level exception to be able to bring him back at the number he got from the Knicks, then they wouldn't have been able to go to where they need to go with Grimes to keep him under the aprons. Like, the machinations of letting Yabusele go indicated that they are planning to bring Grimes back. So if we know that's where we're going and we know that's what both sides are looking for here, it seems like that could get done most amicably of these four situations. The other thing, though, that leads me to think, like, it's the other end of the spectrum. And it's like, well, what's the most like rancorous situation? What's the side where there seems to be the most rattling sabers and like movement in terms of like public commentary on what's going on? And that's the Kuminga situation, because of these four situations, that's the only one where we're getting like regular stories about how it's not close, how everybody's a little bit bummed out about it, how multiple teams are trying to get it to sign. Like, we're not seeing other teams pitched as sign and trade suitors for Cam Thomas or for Josh Giddey. We're at least hearing about discussions going on around Kuminga. So if there's talks and if there's a motivation to maybe make something happen, maybe that leads you to get something done a little bit quicker.
You know, we're talking a lot about body health and improvement, and we're both about the same age, Dan. 40 is the new 30, not just in terms of age and years, but also in scoring in today's NBA, because Quentin Grimes and Cam Thomas have both been like dropping 40 burgers left and right this past year. Doesn't seem to matter. You know, like, what is a 40 burger worth these days? You know, like, we had a 46 pointer from Quentin Grimes and another 40 point game from Quentin Grimes last year in the second half of the year, where they're a bit, I wouldn't say tanking, jockeying for draft position might be the more fair term. Cam Thomas has 9 40 point games in his NBA career, which is more than Kawhi Leonard, which is more than Calvin Murphy, Chris Mullen. I'm going to go Magic Johnson. Doesn't have more 40-point games than Cam Thomas. This list is incredible. Just the number of Scottie Pippen, Grant Hill, Chris Webber, Tim, that can't be right. Tim Duncan has fewer 40-point games in his NBA career than Cam Thomas. Okay?
You heard it here first. Cam Thomas better than Tim Duncan. I know that we're at the part of the offseason where like discussions of Cam Thomas on podcasts get aggregated and then turn out to become like social media engagement fodder. Let's get that one out there. Quote, Cam Thomas is better than Tim Duncan. Tom Haberstroh and Dan Devine, the big number Yahoo Sports.
His agent thanks us very much so. The check's in the mail.
There you go.
Hey, you know what? So if you look at even Quentin Grimes, players who have not had more than one 40-point game in their NBA career, it's not as impressive of a list, but it's something that I think we all need to acknowledge here is that like the agents and the players are probably like, I balled out. Like I averaged 20 plus points a game last year. I should be getting at least 20 million a year, but we're not seeing that. I loved this story from Fred Katz of The Athletic, friend of the program. Fred Katz had a really cool story idea where he did a survey of 16 executives around the league and asked them what is the fair value on these RFA subjects. So Josh Giddey, he had the average annual value of his contract, according to The Athletic's Fred Katz. Go read the piece. It's really fascinating. And the different years that these fair value offers were coming out to, really interesting. Josh Giddey was at 22.3 million. Jonathan Kuminga was at 20.4 million. Average annual salary, according to these 16 executives, the survey. Cam Thomas came in at 16.7 million and Quentin Grimes at $14.7 million average annual salary for these guys. I will point out, though, according to Fred's survey, Cam Thomas did have a higher number in terms of average annual salary than Quentin Grimes, but a much lower commitment in years. So teams or rival executives were more willing to give more years and feeling more confident in Quentin Grimes long-term than say Cam Thomas, more like 2-year deals and 3-year deals as opposed to 3 or 4 or 5 year deals. So, let's start with Josh Giddey here. Let's do a little over under. We haven't done over unders in a while here. Quickly, Dan, Josh Giddey, $22.3 million. I mean, let's peg it at $90 million over 4 years. That's basically what we're talking here is a 4-year, $90 million deal. Do you think that's a little rich for Josh Giddey, or do you think that's right about Goldilocks this for me?
All right. So I think that that's two different questions. So what I'm going to, like, would I go that to that number, or do I think the Bulls are going to, right? I mean, that's kind of where we are. So I think the Bulls are going to wind up over that. I think that it's going to, you know, it'll be closer to maybe like 4 and 100 or somewhere closer to there. If for no other reason, then I think they can't reasonably look at Josh Giddey and say, we're going to give you less money overall than we gave to Patrick Williams. I feel like they can't do that. And like, yes, Patrick Williams is an extra year, but they went for 5 and 90 for someone that they've given a lot of opportunities to prove that he can do something for them, and he hasn't. Josh Giddey at least has shown he can be like the engine of their offense. Whether that offense is good enough to get you anywhere beyond the play-in doesn't really seem to be much of a concern in Chicago, because the play-in is where they're pretty happy being. So I my guess is it's going to come in over that 22.3 annual average annual value, which even still would make him something like the 90th highest paid player in the NBA in terms of average annual value. So I'm guessing it gets done around there, but I mean, the longer this goes, I guess the more they can squeeze.
Yeah, I think there's also investment bias going in here because they've invested trading away Alex Caruso, who was like a swing piece for the Thunder this year in winning a championship. I think it would be crazy for them to let him walk. I know there's a whole sunk cost fallacy. It's like, yeah, just because you invested in trading away Alex Caruso to get this guy doesn't mean you should overpay. But I do think that that's going to play into this a little bit. I think you're right. I think it'll come in at around 24, 25, a 4-year, 100 million. I'd be surprised if it went to 5 years, but Josh Giddey, I think it's played himself into, I think he absolutely capitalized on the opportunity with the Chicago Bulls that weren't really doing much last year, weren't going to be, you know, title contending anytime soon, but he performed very well in winning games down the stretch for them. I think he comes out higher than 22.3. Again, that's coming from Fred Katz over the Athletic, the executive poll summary there, survey. Jonathan Kuminga, 20.4. What say you?
This is really fascinating radio, as I think. I think that I'll go over on that one too, because I think that if what the Warriors are looking for, I mean, the Warriors have had a history. Obviously, a different front office was under Bob Myers. Now they're run by Mike Dunleavy Jr., but like, preserve the salary slot, right? Like, the idea being, okay, well, Kevin Durant doesn't want to be here, but like, we'll sign and trade him so that we can get D'Angelo Russell back to keep that sign and that salary slot open, so we can flip him into Andrew Wiggins and then eventually turn that into Jimmy Butler. But the idea of like, you're already paying your guys, you know, top dollar with Steph Curry, with Draymond Green, whatever. The only way you're adding in talent is to be able to fit somebody into a hole that already exists, because it's not like you're going to get cap space anytime soon. So I think the idea initially was, we hope that Jonathan Kuminga will be that talent infusion for us to move us to our next level. And I think that the optimism on that maybe has curdled to some degree. I think it seems fair to say, when the guy's getting DNP CDs and like must win games at the end of the season and then playoff series, that's probably not where the bridge might be burnt at that point.
Yeah.
But if you're looking to, like, the offer reportedly is, I think the most recent one we heard from Shams and Anthony Slater, newly at ESPN, congratulations, Slater, was like 2 years, $45 million. So that's over the 20 point, you know, like, that's over there. So if that's not getting it done, and there are reported sign and trade deals that might get up to 4 and 90, it seems likely that if we get into a 3 and 75, somewhere in that ballpark, that still gets us over. So let's go with over on Kuminga, even though it seems like nobody's going to be happy about it.
What does it say that the Kings and the Suns are pursuing Kuminga really hard?
I've noted that every team that has been reportedly in on Kuminga to some degree, because the Bulls were in there too. There was like, when the Heat seemed chaotic, it was like the Heat are in there. I'm like, it sure seems like Mike Dunleavy Jr. is trying to just... Who's the last guy at the table that needs to get something done? Who's the sucker we can get something out of? Doesn't seem great. But
yeah, well, the Suns apparently are offering 4 years, almost $90 million, or that's the report from Shams and Slater, which Shams and Slater would be a great podcast, or some sort of like tag team reporting duo.
Great hair both ways also. Got to give them credit for that.
Yeah. I can't compete. Although...
our beard game is strong.
Kings and Suns, I mean, really what this comes down to is like, are the Kings willing to pay Jonathan Kuminga 25 a year at that three-year, yes. 575?
I'm gonna go out here and on a limb and say, yeah, the Kings will pay that guy $25 million. 100%. Yes. No doubt about it. And then it's a question of, are they going to come off of one or more first-round picks and Keon Ellis plus something else to do it? And then all of a sudden the Warriors have like a new war chest. I think that's the answer to all that is yes, eventually. But
you know what's weird about this is like, damn, when you look at this, like the base level compensation, whatever you want to call it.
Base year compensation, BYC, yeah.
Right. The outgoing salary is only going to be half of what the incoming salary is for Jonathan Kuminga. So like I might have gotten that reversed, but the point is that whatever is coming back to the Warriors is only going to be about like half of what the outgoing number is. So if he's getting signed at $25 million, you're basically looking at the neighborhood of the incoming contracts for the Golden State Warriors to be around 13, 14, 15 million. There's a ceiling on that. So like, it almost becomes... incentivizing the Warriors to agree to a number that's higher, because then you can get more contracts back in a trade. So it really is just greasing the wheels on the Kings side, or the Suns side is like, hey, how about like $30 million? Would you guys be cool with that? Because then if it's $30 million, then Grayson Allen becomes even more palatable on the other side, because I think he's got a starting salary at 16 or something like that. So it's almost like I'm taking the hard over on Jonathan Kuminga's 20.4 because of the sign and trade aspect. I think it will come down to Keon Ellis and Devin Carter coming to the Warriors, and then a bunch of picks to beef that up. Apparently there was a report, I think maybe Anthony Slater was reporting that, is like that was the standing offer in terms of players to the Warriors, and they turned it down. But I think the draft package will probably have to increase for the Warriors to bite on that. Any last thoughts on Kuminga before we go to Cam Thomas at 16.7?
No, let's go to Cam Thomas, because I think it's been fascinating to see how the conversation about him has kind of evolved over the course of the summer. Like, I think there's been much rending of garments and argument about when our pal Zach Lowe said on his show that the his understanding of the consensus around the league, such as there was one, if there is one, was that Cam Thomas is primarily like a score first, second and third, and maybe not provide a whole lot of value other ways kind of player. I would submit that that is the way that people around the league have largely viewed him. Maybe that point of view is out of date, considering Cam Thomas increased his assist rate last year. He's, you know, he's shown the capacity to do more things with the ball. Still not a, doesn't grade out particularly high as a defensive player, but like the idea of this is a guy who can score in volume pretty efficiently with the ball in his hands a lot and is an advancing playmaker, if not yet a great one. That doesn't seem like a guy that shouldn't have a market, but it does seem like there's not really one out there for him. So the idea of the average annual value here coming in 16.7, like a little bit above the mid-level exception, it feels light considering some of the guys who have gotten 30 mil thereabouts.
Seems light 25. Considering he's better than prime Tim Duncan too. Yes.
For example, right? Again, let's get that out there. Let's make sure we're getting that out there. I think I'm going to go under on this one, not because I don't think that Cam Thomas deserves it, but deserves to be down low here, but it's because I think the viewpoint on his game and the differences where he says that he has outstripped all these other players in terms of how many 40-point games, he does not provide the same kind of value in other aspects of his game. Kawhi Leonard not having as many 40-point games is not such a big deal considering everything else Kawhi Leonard gives you, right? Tim Duncan, et cetera, other players like this that are providing more value on the defensive end and with their playmaking. Cam Thomas not at that level. Also a smaller guard who seems like if you're going to have to build everything around him, makes him a tricky fit. And clearly the market is suggesting that like no one is saying we feel that he is good enough as a number one creator to go and reshape our financial future to fit him in and do everything around him. So if that's the case, it seems more likely that he's going to have to settle for mid-level money or less, which would put him down below 16.7, which is tough and not cool and what restricted free agency is about. And I think that Cam Thomas would have an excellent chance of dramatically outperforming that number if he's able to stay healthy, which is the other part. He's missed a lot of time with injury in this first couple of seasons. And if the Nets are going to put something more representative in terms of talent around him, which, you know, TBD there.
It's tough to reconcile Cam Thomas and his offensive output and the fact that he's not able to get much more than the mid-level exception. I mean, I think it comes down to we watched the NBA finals with these two juggernauts playing both ends of the floor as hard as they did. It's hard to look at this NBA landscape and say, like, Cam Thomas, if he's, according to EPM, estimated plus minus, dunksandthrees.com, ranks in the second percentile defensively. His expected EPM going forward, second percentile. Offensively, 97th percentile, but that's given the role that he was in and how many teams can really say, hey, give the ball to Cam Thomas and just all the other egos on the team step aside and let him cook. I don't think that you can project him to being a 97th percentile offensive player for most teams in most environments. Those numbers are based on the Brooklyn Nets environment last year and his ability to lift that offense to where they were. I think part of the reason why he was double teamed so much when he was trying to refute what Zach Lowe was reporting, he was like, man, I got double teamed like crazy last year. And I'm like, yeah, because I think defenses are looking at you like he's not going to pass the ball. He's going to try to shoot. He's going to try to shoot his way out of it. And yes, he did increase his assist rate, but I just think it's going to be hard for teams to replicate that environment for the Brooklyn Nets and what he was able to do last year. Now, I would expect him to be under that, under the 16.7. I think it's going to be around 14, 15, a two-year deal, something like 28 mil, maybe 30 mil, two-year deal, maybe a team option in that second year that will allow kind of in that mid-level exception, allow him to be traded into other teams. Fred Katz, again, doing a great job reporting on this story on the restricted free agents. I think that makes sense is that he comes in there around 15. So I'm going to take a little hair on the under for Cam Thomas.
I think the thing that's worth thinking about, like if you know, strip out the jerseys on the, you know, that they're playing for, right? Like how big a difference is there between Cam Thomas and somebody like Coby White in terms of their game and then and their production and what they do? And Coby White wasn't making the mid-level, right? Like, you know, and the next deal that he gets is not going to be for the mid-level. And so I think that's the idea. Is like there's, we have, I think we've sort of focused on what he can't do and maybe undervalued what he can. And in a, if he's able, but you're right, this is essentially gets you like a mid-level version of a prove it contract. Outperform this context in, or the lowered expectations for you on a team with maybe some more competitive talent. You know, Michael Porter Jr. comes in the door. They drafted 17 guys who all need the ball in their hands. So we'll see. But like, show you can do it again. Keep the numbers going up. Keep the assists going up. Keep the turnovers going down. Show growth in these areas. You'll have the opportunity to cash in from there. Because I think there's a chance that at this point, whatever that consensus might be undervaluing what Cam Thomas actually does provide. But it's going to be on him to prove that again.
Quentin Grimes, 14.7. I'm going to go over on that. I'm going to say it comes out to 15. So I'm going to go slight over on Quentin Grimes. Although that's going to be a crowded backcourt with VJ Edgecombe and Tyrese Maxey and Jared McCain. But I do think the 76ers, I think he's older. He's 25 years old compared to Cam Thomas, who's 23, and Josh Giddey, who's 22. And same with Kuminga. I think the 76ers like Quentin Grimes, and I think they're going to come out to about 3 years and call that 45. I'll say 3 years, 45, which would be a hair over the 14.7.
Yeah, that sounds right to me. And then I think that's the get back here for these guys who are getting squeezed and who are not going to be able to get to their average annual value is you're going to be able to get back into unrestricted free agency sooner. That's the idea, right? And then like you go out, you ball out, you earn, like you mentioned Grimes being looking at it and saying, well, look at what I did the second half of last season. It's like you were basically playing in like a consequences-free sandbox in the second half of last season. Like there was nobody else on the team was healthy. Nobody other, like the team was completely out of the playoff race, all those sorts of things. Like show us you do it again in games that matter in a context where it's like you're providing value in a team that does have something to play for. And then, you know, in 2 years, if you get a player option in the third year or whatever, you get the opportunity to go back out and get another bite at the apple. I think for now, also the other part with Quentin Grimes that makes him maybe more likely to agree to one of these deals as like a late, I think it was a 25th pick that when the Knicks took him out of Kansas, like, or out of Houston rather. He started at Kansas, then went to Houston. I think he's only made something like $11 million in his career so far. Like he's not a bonus baby. He's not somebody who got like high lottery money like Giddey did or like Kuminga did. So I think he's much less likely to, and he's already been on, this is his fourth team. New York, Detroit, Dallas, and now Philly. Like maybe you, when you've had that kind of run the first few years of your career, you're like, I'll take the $15 million a year and then, you know, figure it out from there. Like this is establishing that kind of generational wealth, locking in that kind of money, and then we'll go figure it out in a couple of years. I would agree with you. Also go over on that, but also expect in a couple of years, he might have an opportunity to strike it rich.
Rich is how this peanut butter is going to taste now that our show is wrapping up here, and I'm going to start spooning some peanut butter down my gully right here. So
love that. Love everything about that for you.
Love a good peanut butter spoon. Dan, that's going to do it for us this week. Catch us next week on The Big Number. Thanks to Stone, Mike, and the entire squad behind the scenes who make this podcast a reality. Go give us a 5-star review. Please share this podcast with all your buddies when you're going out on the beach or what have you. Tell them about The Big Number Pod and all of the stylings that we do on this show. We'll be back next week with another episode of The Big Number. Until then, work on that summer bod, y'all.